Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Greetings, and welcome to New Books and Public Policy, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Manuel Arredondo. I am thrilled to be your host today. I'm thrilled because I have the chance to speak with Dr. Sandro Galea about his new book, Well, What We Need to Talk About When We Talk About Health. Well was published in 2019 by the Oxford University Press. And in Well, Dr. Galea argues that Americans think about the wrong things when they think about health. He thinks that there's an overall overemphasis in the idea of medicine and health as a commodity that can be bought or served, and thinks that by expanding our view of the determinants, and sometimes the determinants of the determinants of health, we can actually improve our nation's understanding of what it means to be healthy and how making health a priority in everything we do can usher enlightenment across American life and politics. Dr. Galea, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have you. You have had a fascinating career. You're currently Dean and Robert A. Knox Professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. And I've also heard you describe this book Well as something that was really decades in the making in terms of the experiences you've collected both professionally and personally throughout your life. Do you mind? I wonder, could we start with just a little bit of your background in terms of your life experiences that you think were really significant in your decision to write this book?
Yeah, so you know, so I suppose it depends how far back I go, but as I say in the preface of the book, I was born in Malta, which is a small southern European island, and I immigrated to Canada to go to at the end of high school, just before university, and I did my medical school training in Canada. And I practiced medicine in northern Canada for a while, and then all over the world. I was practicing medicine in some rural and remote parts of the world. And I was practicing medicine in Somalia, where I was the only doctor in a large region for a lot of people. And it was there that I suppose I had a bit of an awakening, where I thought, this is I'm doing a lot of good medically, and I am helping individuals, but really, I am not doing anything to help change the foundations that create health. I often use the metaphor of being on the side of the river, pulling people out of the river one after another, but never stopping to think, what is it that is throwing them in the river to begin with? So I decided I needed to learn that, I needed to understand that. And I decided to do that, I need to go back to school, and I did. So I went back to school, and went and got a Master of Public Health, and then I kept going to get a doctorate. And then my academic career has been since then one of real deep concern with social causes, with how the world around us, social economic factors shape our health. And I've been particularly interested in how that affects our well-being. And the book, you know, I've said it took me 20 years to write this book because it really is a set of reflections that have emerged from a lot of thinking over the past two decades of my academic career. And in that respect, the book is a culmination of all those thoughts.
That's very interesting. And I think it's really powerful, the idea of sort of your experiences doing direct medical services, really inspiring and informing your later work in terms of research and policy advocacy. I wonder, I think our listeners would be really interested if you'd be willing to share a little bit more about your experience in Somalia, specifically what kind of conditions you were working under, and if there were, I don't know, my experience in public health is sometimes specific encounters or specific moments really stick with us. I wonder, is there anything that you would share from your experience there?
Yeah, so, you know, in Somalia, I was working with Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and I was a physician in Mudug region of Somalia, which is in northeast Somalia. It's where towns like Galkayo are, it's where the movie Captain Phillips was situated roughly. And you know, I was a doctor and dealing with what comes in through the door in the hospital, and doing minor surgical procedures, a lot of medical procedures, dispensing medication, treating patients. And it was very much what I was trained to do. Remember, I had gone to Somalia after having worked in northern Canada. So I was actually a physician already trained well to be in fairly rural, remote situations. So in many respects, I was the doctor doing what I had been trained to do by the system. I was very grateful for that, and I was giving back, and I enjoyed it very much, and I learned very much, and I emerged with a deep, deep humility about my role and what I can actually do to help people. So it was in some respects an unexpected turn that my mind went to asking these more fundamental questions. Well, why is it that people are sick? And I realized that once I left, nothing was really going to get better. I mean, obviously, I will have helped people. I will have helped individuals. But nothing was going to get better because I wasn't changing anything fundamental, and I wanted to learn that. So that's really how Somalia ties in with the rest of my life.
It's really powerful. I mean, I'm really touched by the idea of the humility you experienced, especially because humility is actually one of the factors that you consider in terms of determinants of health and well. We'll have a chance to touch base about that. I'm really curious to ask more about that. I was wondering just in terms of your decision to write well when you did, and if there were sort of a certain target audience that you were hoping to get this message to at the moment that you did.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm always struggling with that question, to be honest. Was there a certain audience? There was and there wasn't. The book was written for a general audience intentionally. It was actually my first book that I've written for a general audience. I've written more than a dozen other books, but they're scientific books, and this was written for a general audience. And my hope is that it reaches both people in positions of authority, people who have the capacity to make changes that influence health, but also that it influences the general public, that it's actually read by the general public. And because I think that is important, I think that's an important way of changing the public health conversation.
Oh, that's interesting. And that's actually kind of a nice segue to talking a little bit about the structure of the book. Because I think one framework to view it from is there's this sort of balance between sort of macro level things like power and politics, things that can influence the health of the public. And then there's also these really amazing chapters about sort of more internal things like humility and love and compassion. And I was wondering, in terms of the structure of the book, so basically the book is really, it's been called readable in every single interview and every single review that I've read of it. I would agree, but I'm not going to put you through that that same feedback again. I would say that just to describe a little bit for our audience, it's really broken down into sort of 20 sort of really neat chapters. And for a book that's about 200 and some pages, that really comes down to these sort of 10 to 12 page, really nicely packaged units that each touch on a specific theme. How did you go about selecting the 20? Was it whittling down, or was it an expansive process, or
yeah,
how did you end up with the?
It's a good question. It was perhaps a whittling down. I mean, you know, obviously could have been many more chapters, but I specifically wanted it to be short. I have a an understanding that everybody's busy and that I have a theory that people do not actually read long books. And I like the number 20. I mean, why 20, not 19 or 21? Because, you know, 20 sounds better. But it really was a set of ideas that had been germinating. And I had done a number of essays that eventually became this book. And they modified it. And having written a number of essays on a number of these issues, I had a sense of which ones were resonating. And that helped me take what could be a universe of 100 topics into and reduce it into something much more manageable. So I'm not sure that there was any particular method to them other than a recognition that this is an important set of issues that we need to be talking about when we talk about health, which is, of course, the subtitle. I mean, an interesting story, of course, on the title is that the book, my intention behind the book is that the book would be called What We Need to Talk About When We Talk About Health, which was the subtitle. The publisher wisely perhaps said that, you know, it's a very long subtitle and you probably need a short title. And the publisher suggested well as a title to add to it. But in my mind, this book is very much what we need to talk about when we talk about health.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I think that there's a lot of different conversations that can be started from this book. And sort of going back to the idea of there being some sort of macro level sort of systems issues that could discuss, and also some sort of internal sort of issues of self-growth. What do you think, in terms of, you mentioned hoping that people in positions of power would read this book, what would you hope that they would come away from reading it?
It's a good question. I think, I suppose I come down to I would like people who are in a place to make change, recognize that we should move beyond our current secure system to a health system. And moving to a health system means moving to investing in fostering the preventive conditions of health. And that means fostering and investing in safe houses, good schools, and livable wages, and gender equity, and clean air, drinkable water, a fair economy. And these are all the conditions that ultimately shape health.
And in terms of folks who maybe aren't in a position of power, folks who maybe can only work on what they can control in their, maybe not even that much, but have some sort of authority over their decisions or their...
I think we have to remember that anybody who's in a position of power, anybody who's in a position of authority, ultimately that authority is derived from the people around them, from the people who are in their environment. And so I think we all have power and authority in our and ultimately we can all contribute to changing the conversation.
Well, yeah. And I think it's really powerful, some of the passages that really apply to what can we do in terms of things like humility, compassion, love. I would share with you, I'm a clinical social worker. And so for my practice, it definitely felt really powerful to see how perhaps those kinds of things at this point are sort of a privilege, or some folks don't necessarily have the same access to practice altruism or to experience moments of love or compassion. Do you think that's a little bit of an overreading? I mean, do you feel like that at that point, the idea of treating compassion as something that's only accessible to those who are in a position to share compassion, and i.e. aren't in an active state of survival or fear or suffering. I was curious to get your feedback on my thinking in terms of interpreting those chapters and whether or not they're things that can be universally accessible to all, or if they're also sort of things that are, there's inequities and there's disparities in.
Yeah, no, I think it's an excellent question. It's a really good question you're asking. I think you know, somebody said to me that the book, well, deals almost with meta-determinants. You know, it's almost with a philosophical foundations of health. In fact, one of the working titles that we had played with around well was sort of, it's a practical philosophy for health. And that obviously is not a particularly appealing title, so we didn't use that. But it is ultimately intended to be a meditation, as I say in the introduction. It's a meditation on the forces that shape health. It is a set of reflections, and insofar as humility is one of those reflections that's important to have, insofar as wisdom is something that's important to reflect on, insofar as love and hate are important to reflect on, who are trying to reflect on all these forces.
And I'm curious, do you think there's a way to connect those things? As in, I mean, is there a way to have policies that specifically promote things like generosity and compassion and sort of healthy states of mind?
You know, I suppose at core, I'm trying to get people to think about health differently. Now, how many of your listeners, when they think about health, think about love? How many of your listeners, when they think about health, think about place? How many people, when they think about health, think about compassion? And I'm trying to say, you cannot think about health without thinking about love, place, compassion. I don't think you can think about health without thinking about community, without thinking about justice, without thinking about acceptance, thinking about tolerance. These are core parts of health. So I'm trying to change how we think about health.
Well, I definitely think those are some of the most powerful passages. And, you know, I really, of all the quotes you got in terms of, I really appreciated Rosalind Carter's comment in terms of the former First Lady, in terms of just recognizing how these principles can even be more beneficial than scientific discoveries or advancements in technology.
I think they are for both conceptual reasons and for empiric reasons. It's our fascination with science and technology, which I worry about saying this because I worry that that when I'm saying this, it almost sounds Luddite of me, and it's really not. I'm a big fan of technology, and but I think technology is not going to solve the fundamental determinants of health. It really is not. And I think technology creates opportunities. It's an opportunity for discovery science. It's an opportunity for us to do things that are creative, but it is not going to be a one-all solution, as sometimes we think it is. So
I'm curious, are you aware of any applications of technology or sort of medical advancements that you think do address some of the issues and well, or show promise in terms of sort of supporting the idea of a shift in thinking?
I think there are pockets, many pockets, where people actually live these values. I don't think, I suppose in some respects, I have the humility to know that I'm not saying anything. Perhaps one of the biggest compliments I've been paid about this book is when people say, you know, well, isn't what you're saying obvious? And I like that. I really do. Because that means that, that means that I am striking a nerve, that people are reading this and saying, I understand this. I get this. And I want that. I think if we get it, if you get it, I get it, if your readers get it, then together we can change this. Then together we can change the conversation on health. I would like to, when we're sitting around our dinner tables and talking about health, we're not just talking about our doctor, we're talking about compassion. When we're sitting around our dinner table talking about health, we should be talking about what it is that ultimately we need to do to promote health.
Well, I think that is really an impressive part about the experience of reading this book. And I think one of the devices that you use that makes it feel obvious or makes it feel so common sense is some of the vignettes that you use to sort of paint the picture of how over the lifespan, various factors or the factors spelled out in well can really influence basically how and when someone dies. Do you mind? I think it's one of the most enjoyable parts of reading, so I would encourage you not to spoil too many of the details, but do you mind just talking about what the reader will experience in terms of how you use vignettes to paint the picture of the principles?
Well, let me tell you one vignette, maybe. And it's the vignette around the life of Blind Willie Johnson. And I tell the story because I find it very useful to explain how. So Blind Willie was born sighted. He was born in Texas at the turn of the 20th century. He became blind at age 7 when his stepmother threw a lie at his face in a domestic violence incident. And so he grew up poor and blind and black in Texas in the early 20th century. He got married and his house burned down. Him and his wife didn't have any money, so they actually went back and lived in the burnt out shell of their house. And in his 40s, Blind Willie got malaria. Now, this is Texas in the 1940s. Malaria is not that uncommon. There's nothing particularly uncommon about that, but his wife took him to hospital, goes the story, and he was turned away from hospital. And then Blind Willie died. And the question I always ask listeners is, well, what killed Blind Willie Johnson? And the answer is obviously malaria. Malaria killed Blind Willie Johnson. That was his disease, and had he had treatment for his malaria, he would have lived. But the reason I tell the story is because it's obvious it wasn't malaria that killed Blind Willie Johnson. It was poverty, it was racism, it was domestic violence, it was homelessness. It was limited access to care. Those are the forces that killed Blind Willie Johnson. Our investment in healthcare is all about our investment in malaria. And I think I tell this story because it's clear to any listener that if we put all our money in malaria, we're never going to save Blind Willie Johnson. It doesn't mean we don't want money in malaria. It just means that we need to deal with all the other factors. And the book really is about those other factors. The book is about the other factors that shape health.
It is such an outstanding example. It really demonstrates and illuminates exactly what you're saying. And I just think it'd be vital as a case study in so many academic environments, Blind Willie Johnson. I think another thing that is really, really helpful in terms of just how easy it is and how enjoyable it is to read this book is the use of references to literature and to pop culture. Do you mind saying a little bit about how you drew on outside sources to sort of make this book really, really jump off the page for folks who maybe don't have a background strictly in policy or in health?
Yeah, the book really is intended to be for everybody. I don't think you need a background in health. I mean, you need a background in policy at all to understand it, because we are all human and we all care about our health. So the book is, I suppose, the prerequisite to reading the book is being human and caring about being healthy.
Great. And I'm curious, in terms of next steps, are there anything you're working on, or do you feel like well points in the direction of any sort of future, any need for future research? Or
I think there's enormous need for future research. I think there's research about how the conditions of the world around us shape our health, and research about how it is that we can change the conversation on health. And I think it's not just research, but it's also translating that research. And taking the research and taking it up to scale and shifting our lens of vision from one of medicine to one of thinking of the health populations.
And are there any particular models or programs you think we should be investing in specifically, or things that you'd advocate for in 2020?
I would advocate for a wholesale rethinking of how we think about health. I would advocate for us understanding that to generate health, we need to care about the world around us. We need to care about everything in the world around us, from housing to schools to opportunities for recreation to the conditions of our workplace to our interpersonal relations and to all the fundamental conditions that shape health.
That's very interesting. So are there though, in terms of at any level, federal, state, local, are you aware of any particular initiatives that you think our readers should be aware of, or that you think speak to some of the influence of well?
Well, I think there are initiatives all the time, to be honest. I think every single time that we hear about initiatives around housing, around transportation, around social policy, around our economy, these factors all matter for health. Legislation, policy that pertains to gender equity and to whether or not there is paid maternal leave, to minimum wages. These are all the conditions that ultimately shape health.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts about the future, because I think a lot of us are in that mindset where we're trying to figure out, are the trends going to continue to get worse or trends going to continue to improve? I'm curious, I was going to ask you about one specific public health intervention, harm reduction, and if you think that is something that potentially has promise in terms of transforming the way people think about health.
I think there are many ideas that can help transform the way you think about health, and I think that's one of them. And I think that's something where our science is misaligned with our values, and we need to align our values to make sure that we do what's right by our health, even if it's not something that comes naturally or easily to us.
Great. Well, I've taken up enough of your time. I really do appreciate you taking the time to write this lovely book and also to share a little bit more about it with our listeners. Dr. Galea, I hope you have a lovely rest of your evening, and thank you again.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for engaging this conversation.